Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
I'm Dr. Irene Skoronic.
And we are fortunate to have Dr. Skoronic again as a guest co-host, filling in for Dr. Page, who will be back next week. But we're really glad Dr. Skoronic is with us today. And on our show today, Irene, we're going to be talking with Dr. Ali Schwartz, primary care physician and co-director of the Massachusetts General Hospital Down Syndrome Clinic, about Down syndrome. Really excited.
I'm really looking forward to our conversation with her.
And first, though, we've got some really interesting research that matters about identifying early dementia through a new, I think perhaps controversial, screening test. We'll see.
It's an interesting test.
And about does elevated blood sugar raise your risk of dementia?
Then we'll talk about the risks of indoor tanning.
And finally, about maybe a controversial, maybe not treatment for pancreatic cancer, celery and artichokes. Well, let's jump right in, Irene, in our very first research that matters, about some research about a new way, perhaps, of diagnosing early dementia.
It's an interesting test. They used famous faces as a screening test, so trying to identify whether or not people could recognize the famous faces, and that recognition can be an early sign of either dementia or not dementia.
Yeah, and this was actually published in the journal Neurology, a very prestigious journal, and they exposed the participants to common, you know, internationally recognized figures, people like Princess Diana, Muhammad Ali, Albert Einstein, Elvis Presley, Oprah Winfrey, and Pope John Paul II. Would you be able to recognize all of those figures? What do you think, Irene? Would you have been able to recognize all of those?
I think I would have passed and recognized all those.
Yeah, I hope so. But I could easily see that this could also be culturally dependent, that perhaps in some cultures, certainly maybe outside more affluent cultures in the West, I don't know if those would be the figures that they would all identify.
Well, I think you'd certainly have to have this be a culturally sensitive test, so you change the faces depending on where a person is from and probably depending on how old a person is.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And I think this is a really interesting, because it would suggest that perhaps there are some universally recognized figures and faces, and it's a very quick, easy test that you could say, you know, here are five people. Can you tell me who they are? And certainly if someone who is from, let's say, the United States couldn't identify Obama's face, our president, then, you know, you might have some reason to believe that there could be something unusual going on. And so I like it from that standpoint. It's maybe easy to do.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll have to stay tuned, because I don't think this will be a universal, but certainly it's something that we may develop more easily screening tests as we move on. And speaking of dementia, this next research that matters is another interesting way to maybe advance our understanding of how to maybe predict or even prevent dementia. Tell us what the study is about, Irene.
Well, so this looked at glucose levels, so blood sugar levels, in people who are at risk for dementia. And what's different to me, that last one was surprising. This one to me is sort of intuitive, that we know that taking care of yourself and eating healthy and keeping your blood sugar at a reasonable level is good for you. And this study found that among people who had diabetes and among people who didn't have diabetes, higher blood sugar was predictive of signs of dementia.
Yeah, this was actually in the New England Journal of Medicine. We've heard of that journal. And they looked at 10,000 measurements of these hemoglobin A1C levels from 2,000 people without dementia to see then what would happen with people who had developed dementia. And they compared those who had diabetes and those who did not, and they followed them up for 7 years, and dementia developed in 524 participants, 74 of those with diabetes and 450 without, which is a very large number without. But in both cases, just as you said, elevated blood sugars predicted development of dementia. And to me, that's exceedingly significant, exactly for that lifestyle reason you mentioned, Irene.
It's empowering, too, to know that what you eat and the choices you make can actually improve your health.
And there's so few things that we could probably do that have such a great bang for the buck as lowering our weight. And certainly there's not many things that we've talked about on this show as ways of preventing perhaps dementia other than quitting smoking, keeping your blood pressure low. So I think this is, we've known it with diabetes, the pre-diabetes or slightly elevated blood sugar. If you hear that news from your doctor or you hear from your parents that their blood sugars are just a little elevated, take that seriously and try to get that back down into the normal range. That's a take-home message for me.
Absolutely.
Well, let's listen to our next research that matters is one that's, I kind of want to sigh every time I talk about it because it seems like we've talked about it once a year since we've had this show, but it's about tanning and the increased cancer risk. We've known that, but data that continues to show that young women, particularly young white women, still do indoor tanning at very high levels.
I found this surprising too. This comes out of JAMA Internal Medicine and looked at young women as young as high school. And they're going frequently, some of them, 16.7% frequently, to a tanning salon.
Yeah, they went at least 10 times in a 12-month period. And this was almost a third of white high school girls. And you extending out of high school that a quarter of white women under age 35 tanned at least once a year, and 15% also did so frequently. And, you know, it seems like we've been harping on the problems with melanoma particularly, but skin cancer more broadly with tanning. It's a known risk factor.
Maybe we need to do more to communicate to parents and teenagers that it's not just the sun, it's indoor tanning that is a risk.
Yeah, I think so. And I think reset the expectation. Perhaps when Hollywood helps reset the expectation that healthy is not necessarily having tanned skin, then we all can be on the same page here. I'm hoping next year at this time we could report that these numbers are going down. If you have a teenager there or your spouse, male or female, that's considering indoor tanning, the recommendation from us is please don't do it.
And one piece of good news that I learned in reading this is that in healthcare reform in the Affordable Care Act, there's going to be a 10% tax on tanning. So we can discourage it with the pocketbook.
Well, speaking of pocketbook ideas, this last research that matters is a really interesting article, Irene. And it's about pancreatic cancer, which is really, I think, one of the more scary cancers that families have to deal with because there's so little good news out there. And this article, maybe it's good news. Tell us what we found.
Well, I read it as good news, and it's about the impact that some of the flavonoids, and I might mispronounce them.
No, that's exactly right.
That are in celery, artichokes, and herbs, especially Mexican oregano, can have a positive effect on treating pancreatic cancer by killing human pancreatic cancer cells.
Yeah, and that these artichokes and celeries and Mexican oregano contain these enzymes, these flavonoids called apigenin and luteolin. And when they were given before a regular pancreatic cancer drug is given, then there seemed to be a potentially large positive impact on the changes of the cells that would favor treatment, successful treatment of the pancreatic cancer. I don't know if this is something that, you know, one's able to take this directly from the kind of laboratory to the bedside. I think that's too soon. But I don't know. I mean, Irene, for your family members, God forbid they have pancreatic cancer, what do you think?
Well, I am certainly focused on eating fruits and vegetables for a healthy lifestyle when you're trying to prevent illness or when you're trying to treat it.
Well, that'll conclude the research that matters. We'll take a short break. When we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Ali Schwartz, primary care physician and co-director of the Massachusetts General Hospital Down Syndrome Clinic, about Down syndrome. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Irene Skoronek. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Irene Skoronek. Today on Conversations, Irene, we're going to be talking with Dr. Ali Schwartz, primary care physician and co-director of the Mass General Hospital Down Syndrome Clinic, about Down syndrome.
Welcome, Dr. Schwartz. Thank you for being with us today.
Great. Thank you, Adam. Irene, I'm very excited to be here with you guys.
And, you know, Dr. Schwartz, one of the things that we usually like to start with is tell us a little bit about yourself. What was your path to getting interested in Down syndrome? Because I don't think this is something that most doctors, when they first start to medical school, they would know that they wanted to do.
Yeah, absolutely. So I always had a really strong interest in psychology and child development. And then throughout college, began exploring working with people with special healthcare needs. So I did some work in Australia working with folks who have autism. And then here in Boston, I worked at a school for kids with traumatic brain injuries. And one summer, I spent some time at a school with children with Down syndrome. And I absolutely loved that and thought it would be so fun to work with this patient population. Then throughout residency, I still kind of kept that interest, but you're not as exposed, especially in a busy inpatient medical system, to people with Down syndrome and a variety of other special healthcare needs. So in my last year of residency and when I was a chief resident, I started working in the Down syndrome clinic here at the hospital, which was a clinic that had been started back in around 2008 by Dr. Jose Flores, and it was only seeing young adults and adults with Down syndrome. So that's kind of how I got sucked into the Down syndrome world and kind of fell in love, and here I am now.
And I was just going to ask, just real quickly, define what Down syndrome is for our listeners, because it's one of these terms that perhaps most people have heard of, but maybe many people don't know exactly what it is.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think most of us are familiar with somebody with Down syndrome and with what someone with Down syndrome might look like physically. So what it is that all of us have 46 chromosomes in our body, and in Down syndrome, there's actually an extra chromosome. Specifically, there's an extra 21st chromosome. So that extra 21st chromosome comes with some extra genetic material that often leads to a variety of medical challenges, as well as some cognitive challenges. But I think the thing that we're all amazed with over and over in the clinic is that we're commonly taught about all of these medical issues that can happen. But all of these are rather treatable. But what we're not really educated in medical school about and what we really experience all the time in clinic is absolutely how amazing some of these patients are, how some of them are the wittiest, you know, most loyal people I've ever met. They're incredibly musically talented often. They often have a lot of determination and perseverance.
That's a wonderful perspective on Down syndrome. When is Down syndrome identified?
It's a great question. So oftentimes Down syndrome is identified prenatally, so when the mother is pregnant with a fetus, they can pick up on certain signs that there might be a fetus with Down syndrome. And that could either be on a prenatal ultrasound. There might be a finding of the neck or nuchal fold being a little bit thicker, or they might see characteristic facies or some abnormality of the face. And then there might be a heart defect. So that's kind of things that lead to red flags or clues that there might be something else going on. But now, in the last few years, non-invasive prenatal testing has become a bit of a hot topic. And non-invasive prenatal testing is a blood test that can sort of assist or help to diagnose various chromosomal conditions. And one of them is Down syndrome or trisomy 21.
Well, you know, one of the things that I wonder is, and I know we're going to get a chance to talk with it about, is how the paradigm has perhaps shifted over the last maybe couple decades about Down syndrome. And, you know, to help start that conversation, I wonder if we think about prognosis and how people feel about having a child with Down syndrome. You just mentioned characteristics about children that I've got 3 children and would be so proud to hope that they are amazing and witty and musical and determined. Have people always thought about Down syndrome and having children that way, or have we learned more and we're more understanding as society?
I think that a lot of parents back in the 70s and 80s were told that their kids wouldn't necessarily amount to very much, and many families have written books about their experiences and how they have really, their kids have proved everybody wrong. And I think that there's a spectrum like anything else, but most individuals with Down syndrome, given an appropriate, environment to succeed, early intervention, good medical care, opportunities for vocational training, and ways to participate in society, end up having, really wonderful lives. So I think it is kind of a combination of medical advances as well as societal advances, and people becoming a little bit more accepting and willing to work with individuals who have special healthcare needs.
And you mentioned early intervention services. What sort of services are there, and what are the services you offer at Mass General?
So in Massachusetts, all of the kids with Down syndrome will get early intervention. So they'll be seen by a combined, usually physical therapist, occupational therapist, speech therapist, from 0 until 3, and then they transition into school where the school is required to provide those services. But in our clinic, we have our clinic at Massachusetts General Hospital is set up with 5 different clinics, and one of the clinics is our 0 to 5-year-olds. So the benefit of coming to that clinic is that in addition to getting the medical care, they get seen by a combined physical therapy, occupational therapy, and speech therapy team, so that some of the kids who might be struggling with physical therapy and their local, PT through early intervention might not necessarily know how to provide them with different exercises to work on. The physical therapist in the hospital is kind of specialized with this and has seen lots and lots of kids with Down syndrome, and so during that 1-hour visit, they can make recommendations that then the family can go home with. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to let our listeners know that we're talking with Dr. Allie Schwartz, primary care physician and co-director of the Massachusetts General Hospital Down Syndrome Clinic, about Down syndrome. And you're clearly helping us understand some of these medical challenges relating to physical therapy and occupational therapy. What are some of the other medical challenges? And then you also mentioned cognitive challenges, which I think are also equally difficult and important.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a lot of medical issues that might affect a child with Down syndrome, or medical issues that they're at a greater risk for. But fortunately, a lot of them are really treatable. So the first thing that parents are always concerned about is congenital heart disease, because around 50% of children with Down syndrome will have congenital heart disease. And of that 50%, quite a lot of them will have a more serious condition that might require surgical intervention. And oftentimes it's corrected within the first year of life. In addition, there are a lot of other common conditions such as thyroid disease. So thyroid hypothyroidism, it refers to a small gland in the neck that can lead to symptoms like constipation and lethargy or being tired or fatigued. That's a really easy condition to diagnose with just routine thyroid tests once a year, or if symptoms present, and then folks remain on a thyroid supplement for the rest of their life. Hearing and vision abnormalities are quite common, so there are different recommendations for screening depending on how old they are, and again, very treatable. Celiac disease is a gluten allergy, and that's seen in about 10% of individuals with Down syndrome, so it's more common than the general population.
And then what about the cognitive? What about some of the cognitive challenges, just 2 or 3?
So the cognitive challenges, a lot of individuals have an intellectual disability, so they tend to struggle with concepts like math and numbers and time. Language can be challenging, so the receptive language or the ability to understand is often excellent, but the ability to express themselves or speak might be challenged. And they do have some really great strengths with visual skills. They're incredibly visual. They can remember faces, maps, pictures really, really well.
Well, we're going to need to take a short break, but when we return, we're going to continue talking with our guest, Dr. Schwartz, about Down syndrome, and particularly maybe picking up on not only the challenges, but the assets and the strengths that you were discussing earlier, the things that made you passionate about caring for these patients. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Irene Skoranek.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Irene Skoranek. We've been talking with Dr. Ali Schwartz about Down syndrome. Thanks for being with us today, Dr. Schwartz.
Great. Thanks for having me.
What are your recommendations for giving a structured environment to a child with Down syndrome?
It's a great question. Are you referring to a school environment or home environment?
Both, I think.
Yeah. So individuals with Down syndrome are actually really creatures of habit, and a lot of them love structure and routine. And so a lot of times we see behavioral challenges or communication challenges or breakdowns in sort of their mental function at times when changes have been made. So having structure to their day is incredibly important. So having breakfast around the same time, then going to a day program or going to school, coming home, exercising for a little bit, having some TV time, all of that and that routineness and sameness is really important. And if there's ever going to be a big change in their schedule, we often suggest talking about it first and doing it very slowly so that the transition doesn't lead to a lot of unnecessary anxiety.
So if we were to provide the structure, we have a diagnosis, we have a team, because it sounds like there needs to be a team that takes care of it, Down syndrome patients, family team, support providers. What's the prognosis for patients with Down syndrome? Can they live a normal life?
Yeah, so in the 1980s, the average lifespan for someone with Down syndrome was probably around 25 years of age. And now we see people living into their 60s. So people are living a lot longer and fuller lives, and their lives are full of, quality is what we hope for. And that's why having a team approach has been really helpful, so that patients can be seen by the physician, physical therapy, ophthalmology, audiology, psychiatry, et cetera, in a one clinic visit session.
And how is that been the biggest change? Because there's not medications we use that we think of. Oh, there's a medication for Down syndrome. That doesn't really happen.
Right. That's a great point. So cardiac disease and treatment of congenital heart disease, and then treatment of childhood leukemia has made quite a bit of a difference. There is actually new research sort of coming down the pipeline that Mass General Hospital is involved with, and it's going to be two clinical trials with experimentary drugs that may improve the cognitive capacity of people with Down syndrome, and it's going to be targeting adult patients first. But you're right, there really hasn't been a lot of research dedicated to medications and trials for folks with Down syndrome.
Your work is exciting, and it's really fun to hear about your passion for this work. I'm wondering, what is your mission as a physician in this field and the mission of your program at Massachusetts General Hospital?
Great question. So we met as a team last year, and amongst the 20 or so folks who work in the Down syndrome clinic, which is just an incredible group of individuals, we came up with the following mission statement, which is on our website. We are a collaborative, multidisciplinary team serving people with Down syndrome of all ages and their families. We provide evidence-based clinical care, education, and cutting-edge research so that individuals with Down syndrome can reach their full potential.
That's what made you come up with that mission statement?
Well, it was sort of a group mission statement, but I think we all felt like the bits about educating other providers was really important. Educating residents that are coming through was really critical. Research is a big part of the clinic program, and that we want every single person with Down syndrome to be able to reach their full potential, no matter what that is. So really partnering with the community and taking field trips and learning about programs that are out there, and creating these alliances with the community organizations.
How well does, you mentioned that a large part of this is a structured environment in school. Tell us what you know, or what do we know from the socialization process in the school with other kids? I'm thinking in part about bullying that occurs sometimes for children that are different. How well does the school environment, and what needs to be done to be supportive in that environment?
It's really child specific. A lot of kids with Down syndrome, when they're younger, and so in elementary school usually, a lot of them fit in pretty well with their peers. And then as middle school and high school start to come around the corner, there is usually a bit of a gap and a bit of a distance as some of those adolescents are really growing up and trying new things and hanging out with their friends, and there might be a little bit more of a pull away from hanging out with a patient or a person who might have Down syndrome. And so in those settings, we really, really stress that it's important that patients with Down syndrome be integrated into their community so that they can get to know folks who have conditions similar to them and people who don't have those conditions. So the Massachusetts has a great community program, the MDSC, which is the Massachusetts Down Syndrome Society, and they have events throughout the year that really link families together so that a lot of our patients with Down syndrome do have other friends who have Down syndrome, and then they have their typical friends too. But it's really important to kind of have friends that are similar to you in some ways.
Your perspective on Down syndrome is different from some of the things that we hear. I think when people are becoming new parents, getting a diagnosis of Down syndrome is something that's scary. And the way you describe it is that it's a beautiful opportunity and also a challenge. And I wonder if you have any advice for soon-to-be parents or new parents to a child with Down syndrome.
So we see prenatal consults in our clinic, and it's been such an amazing opportunity to just talk with families about what their future might look like, what it might be like for them if they did go forward with the pregnancy, and then also what it would look like if they didn't. And we really try to present families with really open, honest discussions and information, because you're right, it isn't always rosy and happy all the time, but the reality is that no one knows what they're going to get when they have a child. We all hope for happy and healthy. And with Down syndrome, we just happen to know some of the medical and personality quirks that go along with it. So it's been amazing to see patients in a prenatal setting. And then for those that go on to continue and have the baby and carry the baby to term, to see the families afterwards, these families who've had such fear and trepidation and anxiety and really torn throughout their pregnancy, and then connecting beautifully to their child. We also offer a program through the Mass Down Syndrome Society called the First Call Program, which is a remarkable way for parents to be connected with other parents. It's run by a woman named Sarah Cullen, and it's a statewide group of trained parent members who are available 24/7 to listen and share and answer questions and provide information to other potential new parents who are kind of struggling with that decision.
You know, one of the things, Dr. Schwartz, that I found is that I started caring for a patient with Down syndrome a couple years ago who had been seeing residents, but those residents changed every year or two, and that was difficult for the family. But I discovered all the things that you mentioned, providing care to the patient, how amazing this patient was, how much I look forward to seeing this patient in the day, and how funny the visits were. And I wonder if how we go about exposing ourselves and our family and those of us who don't necessarily have a family member with Down to a meeting and finding out this wonderful. Maybe you can share a story of some of your own patients and how they and you expose them to the larger community.
So one of my favorite questions that we ask all of our new families is, what is the thing that you're sort of most proud of yourself? Like, what makes you happy and what are you proud about yourself? And I love seeing those answers, because they're things that don't normally come up in a clinic visit where you're talking about someone's weight or their high blood pressure or whatever else there is. And one of my patients was a patient that I actually saw in my primary care clinic, and he was in his 40s, Down syndrome, brand new patient to me. And he was so well-dressed and put together, so excited to come to the doctor, held the door open for me, couldn't have been more polite. And I learned that he has this incredible musical talent. So he performs for liturgical dancing, which is a type of celebration of worship dancing, something that I wasn't very familiar with. And after speaking with him and his family and hearing about his passion, I sort of Googled him afterwards and found that the Boston College Chronicle had written this about him. I have it here. They said, Mike has an intuitive, instinctive performing ability. He has been such an incredible joy and teaches all the dancers something about the quality of performance, letting it really come from the heart. It's not all about technique. And I think if I hadn't asked that question, I never would have known that. So the key for me is always just remembering that these are people. They have passions and hobbies, and a lot of them have really interesting little quirks about them that makes it so rewarding to take care of them.
We've been talking with Dr. Ali Schwartz about Down syndrome. We're going to need to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Irene Skoranek. We'll be right back. Please stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Calls segment of our show today, we will spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns.
And if you have a question you'd like us to address on an upcoming show, please send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we're going to ask our executive producer, Erica Lloyd, to read us our very first House Call today. We get some really interesting ones.
My sister has a lot of medical problems, including high blood pressure and diabetes. She seems to get a new diagnosis once a month, and she's feeling overwhelmed and depressed. What advice could you give me?
Oh, my goodness. This sounds like some of my relatives, too. Oh, this is hard.
It's really hard to live with a lot of medical problems and not become overwhelmed and depressed.
And I think sometimes, you know, when people come in to see me as a family doctor, a lot of times they may show up for a well-person physical. And by the time they leave, I've told them, unfortunately, yes, you have high blood pressure, and oh, your body mass index is too high. You need to lose some weight. You're not physically active, and oh, your blood sugar is high, and oh, your lipids are high. So they leave there with five diagnoses, and that is overwhelming. And I don't think, as a family doctor, I think about that necessarily enough. What about from a psychological perspective, Irene?
Well, as a psychologist, especially in a primary care setting, I see a lot of patients who have multiple medical problems and are dealing with the emotional effects of it. And I think as a sister to your, supporting your sister, I think one of the first things that you can do is to listen and validate that this is hard. It is hard to live with what she's living with. And at the same time that you validate, you can think about ways to work on helping her be active as a patient to try to change some of the medical problems she's having and also coping with the psychological problems that go with them.
So listening really good is a good listening
That's a really
skill.
Good start.
And helping, perhaps empowering the patient, but maybe even in this case, the sister going with her sister to the doctor's visit so that she has some social support, because mm-hmm. we know that social support can be very helpful as well.
Absolutely.
And then I guess my final question would be about the depression, because the depression could be normal, but the depression itself could also be treated, correct?
Absolutely. The depression could be treated maybe with a medication or maybe with psychotherapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, or another form of psychotherapy that maybe going to that primary care visit and getting a referral would be an important step.
So social support around your sister, but also support within the treatment setting. We all work together as a team. Thank you for that great question. Erica, what's our very next house call?
My doctor asked if I was seeing anyone because my son was running around the exam room. I thought he was just normally active. What do you think?
Well, you're going to hear this from the doctor's perspective, not necessarily the patient's perspective here. I think if your doctor said something to you about your child running around the examination room, and doctors see this sometimes, that it's sometimes so difficult to have a conversation in the room because a child is so busy in that room. When it goes beyond what we would normally see, we feel obligated sometimes to ask, is this child being supported in any way? Are there any other issues that are of concern here that could be in the realm of something like attention deficit hyperactivity disorder or not? But at age two, I don't know. What do you think, Irene?
Well, I think that it's a really important thing to not worry too much and catastrophize, well, my doctor said this and now there's something terrible, or to discount everything the doctor says, well, he's wrong, I know my child. But maybe to think about an assessment. And there, for a child as young as two, there are services available through the Children's Developmental Services Agency to have an assessment, to get a team of people to evaluate your son and think about all the people in his life and what they see, to know if there is something wrong and to intervene early, because it's the right time to try to help if there's something going on.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea, because it's probably not about being right or wrong as a parent or as a provider. Another question that our listener or a patient could ask the doctor is why are you concerned? You know, I think it's one thing to say your child is physically active. It's another to say, I've only seen one or two children a year who are this busy in the examination room. And in all of the cases I've seen over the years, these children oftentimes have some other conditions. And that then maybe would suggest a little higher level of understanding why the physician is concerned.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Well, let's listen to our very next house call. Thank you for that last one.
My mother is losing weight, and we are worried about her ability to live independently anymore. She does not drive, and she's isolated. What do you think?
What do you think, Irene?
I think that as a family member dealing with aging parents, this is an incredibly challenging experience to go through and a difficult decision to make.
Yeah, it's one that increasingly most Americans are dealing with as the population is aging and the baby boomers are now becoming elderly parents or grandparents here, we will face this. And in a society where we have so many support networks, it is easy to become more isolated, isn't it?
It is. And I think, you know, in some ways, as you get older and there are less people in your life, it's sort of one of the most common times to be isolated.
Yeah, what do we do about isolation and social isolation? Because we know that that in and of itself is a cause of so much adverse mental health.
So I think trying in any way you can to get people connected. So connecting with your elderly family members and encouraging them to get out and get involved in communities in small ways.
Yeah, I think that this idea of what community means here, it can be an extended family. Faith communities are ones that that fill lots of needs, but sometimes, particularly when people move to a new area, like a parent moving to be with their children, that seems like a great thing, but all of a sudden, they don't have that community, and you have to form a community, help them form a community.
Not an easy task, and a very important one.
Yeah. Well, we'll have to talk more about this. Thank you for that question. What's our very last house call?
I listened to your show about faith and dying recently. Thank you for having the rabbi and reverend on the show. Can faith ever be too much?
Wow. Wow. That's a really good question. I don't think that's a question that we actually approached with the rabbi and the reverend. The assumption behind much of that show is that faith helps one deal with many of the challenges one has coming at them in life, and a faith community can be very beneficial. But when can faith be too much? What do you think, Irene?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think when I think about the large body of data on faith, I do know that it's good for physical health and good for mental health to have beliefs and faith and to be connected to spiritual communities. I can then think sort of anecdotally about friends who grew up in houses where the family was very religious and they started to feel disconnected from the religion of their family, and the level of alienation and disconnect they experienced was overwhelming and really difficult. So I think in those stories, it certainly can be too much and can be an incredible challenge. I don't know if there's any literature or science on that. I do, you know some personal stories of it.
Yeah, I think it's where one goes to extremes of almost any behavior that sometimes the boundary between healthy and unhealthy can occur. We hope we've addressed questions that are important to you. And I really want to thank Dr. Irene Skoronek for filling in today for Christy Page as a guest co-host. It's been delightful having you today on Your Health.
I've been so glad to be here. And for the future shows, if you have questions or stories, you can share them by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Again, that's yourhealth@unc.edu. You can reach us online at yourhealthradio.org. And you can also follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and our health app. Just search Your Health, one word, for a free download.
We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Ali Schwartz. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Irene Skoronek.
And we look forward to talking with you again next week. Bye-bye.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.